Good evening, San Francisco. Thank you. Good evening and welcome to tonight's special program, the Commonwealth Club of California, featuring legendary director Francis Ford Coppola. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Adam Savage, maker, editor-in-chief of Tested.com, and unemployed former co-host of Mythbusters, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our guest, our very special guest. Francis Ford Coppola makes very few public appearances. Hence, when he does, it is, and I didn't write this joke, but here it is, truly an offer the audience can't refuse. There you go. That is why there are over 1,300 of you here in person, along with viewers of our live stream. Mr. Coppola's appearance is made even more special by the fact that today marks the publication of The Godfather Notebook, an incredible 700-page annotated document covering the groundbreaking film The Godfather from four decades ago, still considered one of the great masterpieces of cinema history. The 1970... The 1972 epic won Best Picture and Best Screenplay Oscars and was subsequently followed by two successful sequels. Godfather II also garnered Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay Oscars. Get ready to come behind the scenes and learn about Brando, Pacino, the casting, the filmmaking, along with personal and professional qualities that make our guest an American icon. Please give a warm San Francisco welcome to Francis Ford Coppola. Oh, they gave me a gavel. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, and thank you all very much.
This book is an incredible document. It's fascinating to read. Can you talk a little bit about what a prompt book is, what its origin is?
Well, I was a theater student as an undergraduate, and a techie. I lived in and out of that theater, and I was often a stage manager. And we were taught to make what was called a prompt book by taking the text, the play, and getting a bunch of loose leaf pages. And there are a number of ways of doing it. You can take two copies of the script. We could only afford one, so we cut holes in the loose leaf paper and glued it in carefully, so that now you had the whole play in a loose leaf with big, wide margins. And the stage manager is the one who calls the show, so he has to say, okay, lighting cue one, blah, 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 and then underline all the things that the stage manager is responsible for. And so I made this prompt book. I took my copy of The Godfather, which I had scribbled a few notes on in pencil, and then I broke it apart, and I built this mammoth thing. It's about that big, very heavy. And my idea was to just go through it carefully, step by step, and sort of use it as an opportunity to talk to myself, say, oh, here's this, underline that. I had a half dozen pencils, different colors, pens. And then I decided to put a typewritten page at each juncture that I felt, not so much by the chapters of the book, but what I felt were the main beats of this big novel. And this came from, there's a book called Directors on Directing by a guy named Toby Cole. I think it's a man. And it has different directors talking about their work. And in one of them is Elia Kazan talking about his work preparing for Streetcar Named Desire. And this was very illuminating to me. This is a wonderful, I recommend anyone who can see it to look at it, in which Kazan spoke on how he prepared Streetcar Named Desire. And what was so impressive was that he had a item there he called the core. And the core was just that. It was in every scene, there's something that is really the essential point that why the scene even exists. And so for the director, he knows that if he achieves the audience understanding what the core gets that, then everything else is gravy, so to speak. And I, of course, I was a theater student in the late 50s, so there were no, the trilogy of God was Elia Kazan, Tennessee Williams, Marlon Brando, you know, to us drama students. And certainly Kazan, of all the movie directors, I always thought just always got the most beautiful performances from the actors. So seeing how Kazan prepared himself for Streetcar was very inspirational to me. So I wanted to go through and certainly for every scene know what the core was. But then I added another four or five. I don't remember. You see, the first one was synopsis. That was just more or less what happened in that hunk of the book. Then the second, I think, maybe was the times, meaning I had set, the book had set the movie in the 40s, around 1945, at the conclusion of the war. So, you know, the times influenced all the imagery at railroad stations. There were always soldiers, and you could feel the mood of the country. So I wanted to write down for each scene how I could use the imagery of the times. Then the third was tone and imagery. That was sort of the style and mood of the imagery, of the art direction, of the photography. Then was the core, I think. And then I think at the end was something I called pitfalls.
I found that the most interesting.
Well, pitfalls was a warning of things I wanted to avoid, you know, that I could fall into. And, you know, I did most of this work at the Café Trieste next to the phone booth. I had my Olivetti typewriter. And, you know, it was fun to be there and all the Italian singing and being. And it was always my dream. One of the reasons why we all moved to San Francisco is from L.A. at that time, myself and my colleagues from USC and UCLA, was we sort of wanted to have a little La Boheme going on in our lives, you know, being in the cafe, working on your work. So I sat there and I would type up this first sheet, the times, the tone and pitfalls, and then go through with all my colored pens and do section at a time. And of course, one of the good, and it was everything that occurred to me, every idea that popped into my head, noting it if it was having to do with action. I think I did it in red. This is 40-some-odd years ago, so I don't really remember so well. but I know that I did these notations and what have you, the idea was that when I was done with this, I could just take all the part that said synopsis and just have that typed up. And then that would be the synopsis of what the screenplay. So in other words, this was done before the screenplay was written. And indeed, when I made the film, I had this army bag that I would schlep around, and I didn't have a script when I made The Godfather. I had this big book, and I always loved that because not only did I have my notes and how I was planning to do it, but I had the original source material. When I made Apocalypse Now, I didn't have a film. I had the little green paperback of Heart of Darkness with me, and there was many things in that movie directly come from the fact that I had that, and that was my reference when I said, oh, what is the scene, what do I have to do, that I always had the opportunity to look at the original source material as well as whatever had been prepared.
Is there a possibility that there'll be a release of the Apocalypse Now annotated?
Well, that wasn't such a big fat book. That was a little green paperback with all of my an interesting note I will say about it is that in the script of Apocalypse, which was written by John Milius, and all of the great stuff, the great quotes, that I love the smell of napalm in the morning, the Valkyrie and the hell, that was all from John Milius' imagination. But I had this Heart of Darkness book, and there's a character in Heart of Darkness, I think he's called the Russian. He's sort of a zany character. He described almost wearing a patchwork of like a harlequin. And we didn't have a character like that in Apocalypse Now. And we had cast Dennis Hopper to play the soldier, the Green Beret, who goes before on this assignment, who was sent before Marty Sheen. And when I saw Dennis Hopper, and and I heard what Dennis Hopper was talking about, I knew there was a guy, a photojournalist in Vietnam. I think he was Sean Flynn, was Errol Flynn's son, who was supposed to be this extraordinary character. And I just said, Dennis Hopper, he shouldn't be the soldier. He should be this guy, you know. And right there with the book with me, we dressed him up and kind of made him a photojournalist. And he was part Ifugao shirt and what have you. And that character in Apocalypse wasn't in the script and was derived, well, it was created by Dennis Hopper in an extraordinary state of mind, I might add. But he was so, Dennis Hopper was so incredibly intelligent, but then with his extraordinary imagination, the stuff that would come out of it. So that entire character only was in that movie because I had the book. Amazing. And I said, well, he could be the Russian, you know? Anyway, that's a side note. So can I make a request that may not be possible? Could the house lights come up a little bit so I can see the people I'm talking to?
I'm sure they can accommodate.
Because I'm really... A little bit of house lights? A little more, please? I can't see anybody. Oh, that's a little bit. A little more. Be generous. You know, I'll give you a little tip, those of you who want to be movie directors. My teacher was a wonderful... a movie director from the 30s, a woman, Dorothy Arzner, and she was a fabulous woman, and she always told me, always sit next to the camera, and even in the years that followed when there was video assist, and it's always in the back somewhere, you know, she says, always sit next to the camera, because not only can you see everything the best there, but the actors can see you, and they're doing it for you. So they want to see you.
Right.
So I'm doing this for you, so I want to see you. Little more light.
So going back to the beginning, you got word that you might be directing The Godfather, and you got an early release copy, and you started marking that one up. So those are the first pencil notes that are in the book that's in this book, and then you slowly layered in more notes and more the synopsis and the stuff. It feels, looking at it, like I'm walking through your mind as the movie is developing in your head.
Well, whenever I read something, even when I have a rule that I'm always reading something, especially when I go to bed at night, that has nothing to do with anything I might be working on, because it's like a little vacation from it. But to this day, I always, when I see something that interests me, I'll always underline it or highlight it. So I was in the habit of, especially when reading some literary material that possibly I had to adapt, I always put my first thoughts in pencil so I don't destroy the book down. And as you know, whenever you write something down, a sentence, a few words, what have you, there's like a kind of, if you put it away, it's like you're putting it into a magic microwave, because the next time you pull it out and look at it, it's the real nucleus of what you felt and is the beginning of something you could expand upon. So I always had a few notes, and at first I was going to just make more notes. I think what happened really is that I didn't like the book so much. I liked parts of the book. If any of you have read the original Godfather book, which of course is everything that's in the movie was in that book, but there was a whole section, must have been a third of it, if not more, which was about a character named Lucy Mancini, who appeared briefly in it, but she had certain anatomical problems, and she finds a surgeon who can correct them, and they fall in love. But it's like a third of the book about this absurd, you know, and I thought, this is like an Irving Wallace book. This is, you know. And indeed, Mario, who was a wonderful writer and the most wonderful man that you could possibly be, he had written it as a potboiler because he needed to make some money for his family. He adored his kids, and they were shy of money. They were living in Bayshore, Long Island, and he wrote The Godfather entirely on research. He didn't know anything other than what he... Of course, the Valachi papers had come out, so there was... some information. So everything he did was on research. And so at first I didn't think I wanted to do it. You know, when I saw the ad for The Godfather in the paper, I thought it was going to be this, intellectual Italian writer like Moravia or somebody, and it was going to be this interesting study of power, which
with the hand with the marionette
puppeteer. It looked like this was some intellectual thing, and then when I read this thing of Lucy Mancini's Private Parts, I couldn't. I don't know if anyone even remembers that, but it was almost half the book. So I didn't really want to do it, and I don't know why they offered it to me anyway. I was absolutely nobody. I just made The Rain People, which, showed that at least I could make a movie with decent acting. I hope they thought that. And I was Italian-American, so if it offended Italians, they could say, well, he wrote it, he did it. And I was young. I was still in my late 20s, which meant I could be easily pushed around. And I was a screenwriter. I had written some screenplays. I had already written the Patton script, so they figured they'd get a free rewrite out of it because the script they had was sort of not very good, and it was all set in the 70s. It had hippies in it. It was all to be shot in St. Louis. And it was very low budget. It was going to cost $2 million, $2.5 million, and it was the studio's chance, to make some money. But what happened was, of course, the book little by little became more popular, and then suddenly I was, in a way, attached to a more important project than my pay grade justified.
And Elia Kazan had turned it down. Many directors had already turned it down.
A lot of directors turned it down. There had been a movie called The Brotherhood starring Kirk Douglas, which was considered a flop. And so the idea of another gangster picture didn't sit well, and so Kazan turned it down, Costa-Gavras turned it down, many, many directors turned it down. And I might have turned it down too, but I had two kids, my wife was about to have a third, we had no money whatsoever, and George Lucas, who at that time was like a young associate, that he had, he's about 5 years younger than me, so at first he started as an assistant, and he was so sharp that, he became like my kid brother, and we had all moved to San Francisco with this dream of having an independent kind of studio with filmmakers. And George said, Francis, he says, you've got to do this book. He says, we have no money. The sheriff's going to chain the door on American Zoetrope because we haven't paid the rent in 2 weeks. He says, there's no other choice. You've got to do this. You're the only one who can make some money so we can get through this. So I realized he was right. And so then I went to the Mill Valley Library. I took out a couple of books on, there were like three or four books on the five families and about the real Vito Genovese and Joe Profaci. And I read those, and they were really fascinating. So then I thought, maybe if I could make it more like that I could do something.
Well, and you say in the introduction that when you'd seen that first cover, you thought this is a book about the depths of power, and that's a repeated refrain you go back to in your notes, that really is the central core of what the story is about. I'm curious. In the beginning of this book, you have your list of all the characters and the actors, and it looks on the page like you knew exactly who you wanted to play most of the parts right off the bat.
Well, I was trying to do a little personal film involving an Italian-American guy, sort of like myself. I always believed in the words of Strindberg, write what you know and get yourself into an emotional state while you do it. So I wanted to write something personal, and I had heard about a guy named Al Pacino. He was in he was in an Israel Horowitz play in New York. And
the Indian said, Wants the Bronx.
And
right?
I invited Al to come to San Francisco and just to meet and to get to know him a little bit. And he did. And we kind of went around San Francisco. I was always shocked how much all the girls liked him. he's a little guy. Wasn't like movie star handsome, but he had a something that really worked. And at any rate, what happened was that, you know, he went home and I had met him. So that when I read The Godfather, you know how that happens. Every time I describe Michael Corleone, I always saw his face. And, you know, when he was there with the two shepherds in Sicily, with this scene in particular, I just saw Al Pacino. And it's very hard, once you see something, albeit in your imagination, it's very hard to have them suddenly say, well, Ryan O'Neill should play the part. Which is what they said. Because there had just been a big hit for Paramount called Love Story, which starred Ryan O'Neill.
Wow.
And then they said, well, maybe Robert Redford could play the part. And and indeed, you know, it's not as absurd as it sounds, because the Sicily was sort of ruled and occupied by the French for well over 100 years, and they are, Sicily is full of blondes with blue eyes, the Sicilian. And if you see an Italian blonde hair, blue eyes, it's likely he's from Sicily. But nonetheless, I had that image of Al Pacino, and that was what gave me the stubbornness to resist the fact that they absolutely rejected that idea.
Well, and so you said that the studio hired you because they thought they could push you around, and I've read extensively that they fought you a lot on putting Pacino in the role of Michael.
Absolutely. They didn't want Pacino at all. And later I realized this because Bob Evans, who was the head of production, he's a kind of tall, good-looking guy. And I guess he wanted someone to look like him, and I wanted someone to look like me. But at any rate, after I finally agreed with George that I had to do it and I wanted to do it, and, you know, they didn't pay me. I mean, they offered me two deals, I remember. One was $75,000 to do everything, right, and direct, and 10% of the net, or $125 and 6% of the net. And I was absolutely broke, and I had a lot of, you know, I was very much... I was a family, and so I took the $125,000 and 6%. But I said, 7's my lucky number. Please give me 7%. And they said they would, but they never did.
Somewhere there's an extra percent hanging out there. How early in the reading of the book did you know that you wanted Marlon Brando to play The Godfather?
Not early. You know, oddly enough, when finally his name did come up and talk about it, Mario said that he had always wanted Brando, and even before I was involved, had suggested it, and they said, oh, absolutely not. Marlon Brando is box office poison, and he's a lot of trouble, which he was. I mean, in the sensibility of Hollywood in those days, Marlon, I mean, he's such an extraordinary person as well as actor, but he had just been in a Gildo Pontecorvo film called Burn, Quemada. And it was pretty, actually a good film, but it was total, no one went to see it. So they had this idea that Brando, aside from his alleged misbehaving, which I don't know how true it was box office poison, so they absolutely. And, you know, the names I heard floated were Danny Thomas. You know, Danny Thomas is, you know, he's Lebanese, which is close enough, or I think Ernest Borgnine was suggested. Even interestingly, they had a brilliant idea to maybe Carlo Ponti, who was not an actor but who was a real Italian producer. It was tricky. The character was in his 60s, so it wasn't as though you were going to really find a newcomer, you know, that suddenly could act. And so much later, I worked very closely with my associate, Fred Roos, who was a co-producer and a great casting talent. And we finally said, well, who are the two greatest actors in the world? We said, well, Marlon Brando and Laurence Olivier. So Olivier, you know, of course, both of them had issues. I mean, Brando was only like 46, so he was young. He was not Italian. And Olivier really looked like Vito Genovese at that age. If you look at the pictures of who was one of the famous five guys that... I think that Mario synthesized the character out of Vito Genovese and Joe Profaci, put those two guys together. And then we heard that Olivier was too ill. At his latter part of his age, he was English, so... So we settled on Brando, but absolutely a stonewall. They had already turned down Pacino, and they kept wanting to do more screen tests. So we had the cast, ironically, that was actually in the film, all up here in San Francisco. My wife, I think, gave them a haircut, Alan. And we knew more or less who we wanted, but Paramount spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to do real formal screen tests. We tested every young leading man in the business. Ultimately, they never would accept Pacino. Right to the end, I thought, I'll tell the story, it's pretty funny. So as for Brando, they absolutely were adamant. And I was even told in one meeting by the president of Paramount, Francis, as the president of Paramount Pictures, I want you to know that Marlon Brando will never appear in this motion picture, and I forbid you from discussing it any further. So with that, I kind of fell out of the chair onto the rug or some dramatic gesture of helpless protest. And then they all looked, and then I got up. I said, "Well, if I can't even talk about it, I mean, what? How can it be? How can I direct a movie? I'm not even allowed to talk about it." And one guy said, "Well, listen, if we cast Brando, Joe Doakes, an unknown, more people will come than if Marlon Brando was in it." That's how much they were against it. So finally, they said, "Okay, we give you three conditions: one, if he does a screen test; two, if he'll do it for free; and three, he has to put up $1 million bond to guarantee that there'll be no shenanigans on the set." So I said, "I accept." because at least we were talking, And I put myself, I was terrified of, I thought Marlon Brando was, a dream that I was even talking to him, But I said, Marlon, you're not really Italian. Maybe we could do a little improvisation or something and for you to kind of get comfortable. So I had heard, I know you want to talk about the book, but I thought it'd be fun to talk about the casting of Marlon we'll go over our time. So I had heard that Marlon didn't like loud noises, that he often wore earplugs and stuff. So I got together with some of my San Francisco colleagues, some cameramen. I said, "Listen, let's dress in black and no one talk. We'll just do sign languages when we're there." So we fly to L.A. with our cameras, and I had a little early Sony, one of the early Sony handycams. And we knocked on the door, and the maid let us in, and we set up our camera very quietly. There was a beautiful little baby on the counter. That was the daughter that passed away. I always think of her. And we were all ready, and I had brought, little sausage and little, mortadella, and put little dishes of provolone around and Italian cigars. And then the door opened, and out walks this spectacular man with flowing blonde hair in a Japanese kimono. As I said, he was around 46 years old. And he comes out, and, he caught what was going on like that. He's so sharp. And he came out and he rolled his blonde hair up into a bun and he got some shoe polish and he started making it black. And I'm shooting him, and I'm going to my ninjas, all this kind of. And then he put on a shirt. And I remember he took the lapel and he went, "Oh, those guys always have, their lapel is always folded." And he started folding his lapel. And then he said, "You should look like a bulldog." So he took some tissues and he stuffed it in his... And I'm shooting this whole time for this gorgeous blonde Adonis. And then he said, in the story, he gets shot. So maybe he should talk like this, because he's shot. I said, yeah, Marlon. And then he starts sitting like we're here, and he's sitting there, and he's taking the sausage... And he takes the cigar, and he's totally using all of these props to arrive at this Italianness. And he's going, and then the phone rings in his house. So he picks up the phone and goes, I have no idea who that was, you know. So I took the, I had this, and he was very gracious, and I left. And I couldn't believe the transformation I had seen. So I took a wild risk, and I just flew to New York on my own. And I went to the Gulf and Western building, which is now, well, I went to the Gulf and Western building. And I went up to the floor where Charlie Bluthorn was the owner of Paramount. Charlie was a very interesting guy. You were allowed to call him Charlie, so I, you know. But he was from Vienna, so he sort of had a Viennese accent. And I knocked on the door, and the secretary said, oh, could Mr. Bluthorn, I have something to show him. And I set up the tape recorder right in a kind of small boardish room that was right by his room. And he came out. He says, Francis, what are you doing here? I said, Charlie, could I just show you something? He says, sure. So I go and I turn on the thing, and there is Marlon Brando in his blonde hair coming out of the door. And he says, no, absolutely, that's incredible. And that was it.
Amazing. It sounds from your stories like there were a lot of disagreements with the studios, and you say in the introduction that you should say that the film had ups and downs, but you described the film as for you having downs and downs.
Well, I always thought I was going to be fired. And I mean, I after a while, I was sure I was going to be fired. And we were totally stuck on the Al Pacino thing, but Brando had been cast. And they sent me to England to go spend a little time with Brando. He was working on a film called Mortori, I think it was called. And he was such an extraordinary man. So I went to this little English house where he was staying, and I waited in the room, and I heard footsteps coming. And it was him carrying a tray of things for me. I was, you know, like some coffee and cakes. And how brilliant he was to know that if he kind of played the role of a servant, that would put me at ease, you know?
Yeah.
Which is why I think he did it. I mean, so we talked, and it was very nice. And when I was flying back, when I got off the plane, I called my secretary, and the message she gave me was a message. And she said, don't quit, let them fire you. So I immediately knew what that meant. What that meant is if I quit, I wouldn't get the $125,000. And I needed the $125,000. I mean, I had a little family there waiting, but if I quit, I wouldn't get it. But if they fired me, I would. So then I called and I said, "Look, don't even make me bother to come in." You know, and they said, "No, everything's changed. The cast is going to be Al Pacino, Jimmy Connors, Sonny, Talia, your sister." And it's true, I didn't think my sister was right from the part because my sister's so beautiful, and I thought Carlo's wife should be some girl that only gets married because her father's a big shot, you know. But she did wonderfully, of course. And the other cast, Johnny Casal and Bobby DeVille, was okay. And I said, well, what happened? I said, because Pacino had taken another part in a movie called The Gang That Wouldn't Shoot Straight. How did this happen? He says, well, We sorted it all out. I said, well, how can they change? He said, well, we saw some footage from a film called Panic in Needle Park that Pacino was in, and that they thought he looked really good. So that's how. So I was told, you know, I thought it was curtains. And we began the movie subsequently with that cast. Although every week I really, the rumor was I was going to be fired.
That's terrifying.
My wife, who's sitting here, remembers when the editor had lunch with her, and the editor said, I don't know, the footage doesn't cut, I'm so-and-so. But the editor wanted to be made the director. And he had asked me to hire some of his friends to be the assistant director and stuff, so there was an active group within the company that was rooting to fire me. So one day on a Tuesday or Wednesday, like we are now, Brando finally came in, and he shot the first scene, which was the scene when they all meet with Sollozzo in the kind of olive oil company. And they didn't like, they thought you couldn't see him, the photography's too dark, and he mumbles, you couldn't understand him, and they were very upset. So I said, listen, it was his first day, and he was a little nervous, and he was, you know. I remember when I said, Marlon, are you stalling? Let's go do this. And he says, because I get scared, too. All actors get scared. Of course, that's part of it. So I said, well, we're right down here. I could run right up there into the olive oil factory. I'll just do it again. I'm sure we'll do better. And the producer said, Francis, they're going to fire you this weekend. So they don't want to back up and do that. So I said, well, I get it. You know, why do they always fire the director on the weekend? So the other director can have the weekend to get ready and then Monday have a new start. So it was a Wednesday. So I knew who the 14 people were who were actively the conspirators. So I fired them all on a Wednesday. Now, no one knew, including myself, whether I had the authority to fire them. You know, so what you do when you're young and have no clout is you bluff. And I just fired them, and they were all on the phone, can he do this, blah, blah, blah. But by the time the weekend came around, to when this curtains would have happened for me, they then saw the new day of shooting of Marlon, and oh, it was so great, it was so, they were, no, we're not going to fire you, and Charlie took me over to the Palm Steakhouse with my father and bought me steak, and oh, we're behind you. But, you know, in the movie, the scene is from the first day that they didn't like. So.
We have some questions from the audience. The first one wants to know, what was it like collaborating with Mario Puzo, and how did you guys work together?
He was just the most wonderful man, and he was in the East. I would write the screenplay, and then I would send it to him, and then he, in his novelist way, would write all these wonderful changes. One sticks out in my mind is that I can cook a little bit, so I had one of the characters, Clemenza, talk about, I figured it's good in a movie if you have a recipe. So he explains how you brown the sausage and you put a little sugar. And the note from Mario was, gangsters don't brown, they fry. So Mario was always there making it better.
Yeah.
And I knew that Mario loved to gamble. So I said, let's just go to a gambling casino and work on one of the final scripts. I don't know if that was the first Godfather. It was the second Godfather. So we used to go to the Pepper Mill in Reno, me and Mario. He used to just blow money on the roulette table, and people would say, oh, poor guy. And he would say, we're losing thousands down here, but we're making millions upstairs. He was just the most wonderful man. And, you know, there's a reason why when the movie starts, it says Mario Puzo's The Godfather, is because, you know, he really wrote The Godfather. And I've always felt that, you know, I've adapted a lot of, I've written scripts from scratch and I've adapted authors. But, you know, whoever wrote the original book or the play did the heavy lifting, you know, so I always had, always felt that it should be their name above the title. And on all my movies, you'll always see, even Bram Stoker, whoever it was, if you wrote it, that's the hard part. I've written some from scratch, but it's much harder to write a thing from scratch than to adapt a novel into a screenplay.
We live in an age now where it's relatively easy to be a film aesthete. You have access to a tremendous library at any given time, even on tiny devices. But when you were making The Godfather, it was hard work. You had to work very, very assiduously to educate yourself about the history of film. What were your inspirations visually in the tone of making The Godfather?
Well, just also it was hard because you really typed it. And I always had a rule when I did a rewrite, I always would put the old script on my left and I would type the entire script over on the theory that by forcing myself to type it all, I would be rewriting everything, which was true. No more, none of the cut and paste that we're used to now. So your question was about...
what were your inspirations?
Well, you know, I was a 17-year-old living in Long Island with the beginning of the art house phenomena. So we were seeing films of Rossellini and films of Bergman and films of Fellini and films of all of those extraordinary Italians, at the same time that we were seeing films of Orson Welles, the film of Orson Welles, and Kubrick as a 21-year-old, and then all of the wonderful artists who worked for the Hollywood studio, Louis Milestone and William Wyler, and these beautiful films that were made in the American system. So we were sort of caught in this cross-current of pollinization, the auteurs, and then as you dug into it, you saw the silent films of Pabst and Murnau, and it was... the cinema is only 120 years old, but the urge to make cinema must have been building up, and so that when it finally happened because of the technology, it just burst out. I mean, I'm sure that Goethe and Strindberg and Schiller would all have been making films because they were all writers and poets and scientists, so they would have loved this film. So my theory is that the human race just... when they finally got the gift to be able to have cinema, they just went mad. And people say, what's the best film ever made, or the best? What are the best 300 movies ever made, or the 400? In the silent period alone, in those few years, there were probably 50 masterpieces made. Murnau once said, he said, sound had to come, but it came too soon. Because they were really learning how to tell stories with images. So the wealth of our heritage, of hats off to Marty Scorsese and his film preservation, because many of these films were on the way of being lost. So the film heritage of the world is so extraordinarily rich, and from all the different countries.
We have another question from the audience. Your wife, Eleanor Coppola, is also a filmmaker, and this audience member says they love her generous and astute writing to Hearts of Darkness. Can you speak to the role she has played creatively to your own work and process?
Well, Eleanor is my first wife. and she is here. I won't embarrass her. Will you stand up and wave to everyone? Eleanor has just made her first feature film. I won't say her age, but she's in the book of records as the woman to make her first. But, she came from, she's Irish, and came from a sort of a bohemian artist father living in a bungalow on the beach in Sunset Beach. But she always was very much caught up in arts, the visual arts, the plastic arts. She herself has made many kinds of artworks, even getting into the conceptual art and performance art. So, it was a good match, as our children attest to, because we have really neat children, all of whom are on their way. I don't know, it must be a contract in blood the Coppolas have to sign, because every one of them has made a feature film. And I think her input on the kids and my more Italian version of it all has not only imprinted the kids, but also us, me, and I think I've been a big influence on Eleanor, which is as it should be.
I recently watched The Godfather a couple of months ago, and I was struck with how fresh the opening wedding feels, how fresh it still feels. I've seen it dozens of times. And in your pitfalls in the opening scene, you say specifically, I don't want it to be like these jokey Italian accents. You want it to feel like you're there.
Well, I am a true Italian American. I'm all my four grandparents, two came from Naples, and to come from Lucania, which is the Arch of the Buddha, otherwise known as Basilicata. So I was raised, my mother, I remember in the late 40s, said, oh, you're so lucky, you're American, and American is the greatest country in the world. My father said, yes, but you're Italian, and you have... you have the culture of the great Michelangelo and Leonardo, and he took credit for Archimedes, too. So we always felt really, wonderfully unique because we were American and Italian, and we ate pizza when no one else did. Because pizza was brought back by the GIs from the Second World War. People didn't know about pizza. My family were all musicians, classical musicians, for the most part. There were some tool and die makers and those kind of skilled mechanical people. But what I did is I took what my home life was like, the same exact, and the only difference being that my family were musicians and not murderers. So it had all the textures of a real Italian-American, and that wedding is what we call a football wedding. Why a football wedding is because the food are these sandwiches wrapped up in a kind of crinkly paper that say prosciutto or capagol or provolone, and it's a football wedding because you always used to throw, hey, send me a prosciutto, and you throw the prosciutto. And the little kids were always, they would say, slide around the sandwich man, you know, the little kids at the wedding. So all I did was take that kind of wedding, and I was blessed to have my father and mother, who, like gypsies, just came with us because it was a job, you know, that we were doing. And he was always providing the band at the wedding, all of those tarantellas and the musical things he wrote. Except for, of course, the famous song. And so it was a kind of family. It was like a film about a family made by a family.
And you also have a bunch of notes about wanting to make sure you can communicate that Johnny Fontaine is a big movie star, but you've clearly seen many times in which this type of introduction of a character has been mangled by filmmakers. And you want to communicate
Of course, everyone knew this from the book, that it was possibly, that it was the story of Frank Sinatra, how he got the part in what was From Here to Eternity. So Sinatra had run into Puzo in a Beverly Hills place and really castigated him, really was mean to him, you know, because of putting that in the book. But once I ran into Sinatra, I'm all right, he was there surrounded by beautiful girls and stuff. And he looked at me, he says, let's buy the book and I'll play the Godfather, he told me. I ran out of there. So I knew that I had to get, I saw a guy more like Eddie Fisher, or who was not Italian, obviously, but he lived in our neighborhood when I was a kid, Eddie Fisher. Or Vic Damone. I really wanted Vic Damone, but Vic Damone was too scared of the Cosa Nostra to do it. So we had a lot of trouble finding someone to play that part.
All right, and we have another question from
And of course, I thought the way to set him up that he really was a star was just to have a lot of teenage girls screaming as they did in the 40s for Frankie.
And it feels like you're watching a documentary. It feels totally genuine.
Well, you know, The Godfather had one of the world's great photographers, Gordon Willis, one of the world's great art directors, Dean Tavalaris, one of the world's great costumers, Anahil Johnson, who did all of On the Waterfront. So, you know, sometimes you get lucky, and a movie is such a collection of collaborators, and everyone, and then the music by Nino Rota, the hair and all the prosthetics, everyone was just superb. And I remember in the early days, The Godfather, you know, I would get some flack. All my films have always been greeted by a little ambiguous, even The Godfather, you know, especially in San Francisco. And someone said to me, but the film is great photography, great acting, great art direction, great, so what did you do? I said, well, I picked them all.
Another question. Oh, actually, no, I'm curious about The Mists of Blood and your collaboration with Dick Smith on the film.
Not only Dick Smith, who was an extraordinary talent, as we know, but I was, anyone with a half a brain can see, that I was very impressed with Bonnie and Clyde, which was directed by Arthur Penn. And Bonnie and Clyde had some of the neatest live-action effects. Live-action effects is when the effect is really done there through trickery and not, of course, not later as an optical effect. So live action effects are like the grasshoppers in The Good Earth were clothespins, like the cyclone in The Wizard of Oz is a great big windsock on a track that went a different way in the ceiling and the floor. So these are real geniuses, these guys. And I was so impressed with Bonnie and Clyde, which also was Dean Tavalaris, that I found the effects guy whose name was, A.D. Flowers. God, how nicely. I think of him playing that card game. A.D. Flowers was his name. And, you know, the thing about violence in a movie is you it's a little bit like a magician because you have to employ misdirection. You have to let the audience is way ahead of you. So if they see the car speeding around the thing, they know it's going to roll over three times and burst into flames. So you almost don't have to do it. But if you can get the audience to think something else is going to happen and then hit them, for example, everyone knew the scene of the horse's head. And the horse's head in the book, the way it's done, is, of course, the movie producer who has the prize multi-million-dollar horse is to wake up in the morning, and the horse, the severed head, is on the bedpost, and he sees it, and he's horrified. Well, I thought everyone knows that, but what if I put the horse's head under the sheets at the foot of the bed, so when he first opens the sheet, he sees the blood, he thinks that he's been something amputated or stabbed or something. He sees the blood, and he's horrified, and then he flips it over, and then he sees the horse's head. So whenever I could, I tried to do the violence to mislead the audience a little bit and to think it was going to go to the left when it really was going to go to the right. And A.D. Flowers was such a genius. When they shot Mo Green through the eye, I said to him, oh, I want a scene where they shoot some right now. Well, that's an impossible effect to do. How do you do that effect live? Today you can do everything fake. And he had two tubes going up the eyeglasses, one with air, one shot a BB out through the glass, and the other did a spurt of blood. That's A.D. Flowers. He could always figure out how to do these things.
It shot a BB right next to his eye,
but it went
out.
Yeah, and the air that shot it out also blew any shards away from his eye. That's how that was then.
On the DVD of The Godfather, there's tons and tons of screen tests with different actors, and as you talk about some of these actors and we hear the audience laughing, it's clear that you took every suggestion seriously and saw what that person could bring to the role. What was the most ludicrous suggestion the studio had for you for someone to play a role in The Godfather?
You know, maybe some of the Michael choices. I mean, they didn't care whether that made sense or anything. It was like if they had something, like, you know, like Ryan O'Neill. I mean, you could have done it. Anybody can be anything if you have if you see a path that you could take, you know. But I think the stupidest decision was they wanted me to make it all set in 1973 and shoot it in Kansas City. Hey, can I do something wild? Can someone just wants to ask me a question? I know you wrote them, but just raise your hand who wants to ask me. This young lady right in front of me, and just shout it out.
I am a very proud granddaughter of Italian-American immigrants, and I'm so inspired by how you changed the narrative of Italian immigrants.
She's a proud Italian-American granddaughter. What's... Okay, she's giving me a pitch. She wants to know. I'll repeat what she said. She wants to know if I would make a film. There actually has been that movie.
Those four people, they show determination.
Yeah.
And like the love of the statue.
I got it. I'm going to tell them. There is a beautiful movie on it. What's that movie that was made of the immigrants that has... The Golden Door is beautiful, about the immigrants coming on the boat, and that's already done. Okay, that wasn't a question. I'm going to do one more just so we have a little feel for audience participation. And I'll repeat the question. The guy with the blue shirt there.
Thank you, Mr. Copeland. I am Richard Billinger, and I am wondering, and I'm hoping to star in another film project soon, and I'm wondering if you have any advice on production or working with actors, any pieces of advice you can give me, and also, will you hire me?
Also what?
I will missed that last part.
What was the last part?
Will you hire me, please?
Will you hire him?
In the wine business? You know, normally I tell young guys who ask me that question, what should I do, and I say, get married. Because it was the fact that I was married young and I had this wonderful little family that I wanted so hard to be able to take care of and provide for that. Instead of going out and being the wild Hollywood guy in nightclubs, I was at home writing scripts. So I take the fact of my early marriage as one of the reasons why I had a young success. Seriously, though, about actors, try to get at least 3 or 4 days of rehearsal. Films don't ever rehearse. But you can do so much just in an empty room with your actors, just getting to know each other, having them be in character, doing improvs and playing theater games. I always did a rehearsal. The Godfather, the really breakthrough night was very early. We were in Patsy's restaurant, and I had arranged for a back room in an Italian restaurant uptown New York. And I set up it to look like a dining table, you know, with and it was Marlon's first night to be with the actors, and they were just terrified and enthralled to meet Marlon Brando, as were we all. And I had ordered an Italian meal, and I had Marlon at the head, and to the right was Al Pacino, the Johnny Casale, Jimmy Caan, Robert Duvall, and my sister Tally was serving them the different courses. And I said, do an improvisation. When you do an improvisation, you usually tell each participant some little secret thing that they should work toward. But they're basically just making up the scene. And, you know, Al was being, like, very intense and sensitive, you know, to impress Marlon how intense and sensitive he was. Jimmy Caan was just cracking jokes and, you know, bada-beep, bada-bop, and was impressing Marlon how funny he was. Johnny Casale was just the sweetest guy on earth, and he was just sitting there being sweet. And Robert Duvall was, every time Marlon wasn't looking, he was doing Marlon Brando imitation. And my sister Tally was just terrified, and she was just a young girl serving meal. But I tell you, after that three-hour improv, they were a family. So when you work with actors, especially when you use something sensual like food or music or dancing, you can really bring the actor along. For years, I thought that you get them to the point where they become the character. But recently, doing a very good improv, I realized, oh, no, that's not what happens. Eventually, the character becomes them, because it's the actor that really does it, is the flesh and blood person, and the character is an apparition, a phenomenon that inhabits them. But that process is very magical, and if you have a few days to work with the actors, that's why I think everyone who wants to be a filmmaker should at first just do one-act plays, because if you do one-act plays, you're working with the essentials of what cinema is, which is writing and acting. Of course, cinematography and editing and all that are extraordinary disciplines and very essential, but you can make a movie that has wonderful acting and wonderful writing and terrible everything else, and it can be a wonderful movie. But I don't think you can make a movie that has terrible writing and terrible acting and beautiful art direction. What do you have, you know? So it's acting and writing is the oxygen and hydrogen that makes up the work itself, you know. So I would work in one-act plays, because if you work in a one-act play, it could just be two actors. Every major playwright has written dozens of wonderful one-act plays, and you can have two people. You can get together with your friends and have three people each do a one-act play. And there's something very essential that you have that you don't have in all your little cinema short films. You know what that is? The audience. When you direct a one-act play, you know how the audience reacts to your work, whereas when you make a film, it takes 4 months by the time you have it edited that you get the audience. So that's my answer to you. I'm now going to go back to the official. I just enjoy talking to people, and I can see you, so... Also, if you see the person, you know whether to disregard the question or not. He says, here, I have no idea.
The man in the blue shirt was actually one of the questions I was just about to ask, actually. Here's one. Did the immense pressure you were under on the set of The Godfather push you to make the film that you made? Do you think it would have been... Do you think you would have had the same result in a relaxed atmosphere?
You know, for years... My family and people know me think that, oh, he has to be under pressure to do anything any good. But I've always been under pressure, so I don't know. That's one of those hard questions to answer, you know. I have no idea. It's never relaxed. A director has to make 1,000 decisions a day. You know, it's a, should her hair be long? Should it be short? Should he have a... mustache. Some of the funniest things I've done is deciding with Robbie De Niro whether or not he should have a mustache or not, or whether he a certain pair of shoes. He comes with shoes. What do you like these or these? I said, well, I like those. He said, well, you don't like these. I said, well, I like those too. But you like those? Yeah, I like those. But you like these, so do you want these? I said, yes, those are good. He said, no, but you like that one. So I said, Robbie, let's flip a coin.
An audience member wants to know, to what extent did you intend for the Godfather movies, especially Part 2, to be a critique of capitalism?
I think right from the notebook, I think it's in there. There's some good things that were underlined and pointed to with, like, you know, the book is sort of my dialogue. It's not a book. It was my workbook. I never, you know... thought that it would be published. I didn't think it could be published because it contains the whole Godfather book, so you'd have to get that publisher to agree. I don't know how they did it. But like there are paragraphs in The Godfather where I said, this is what the book is about, so I knew I had to figure out how to get it. You know, the big difficulty of adapting a novel as a screenwriter is that a movie is meant to see in one sitting. So what's that, 2 hours, 2 hours 45 is what The Godfather was. But a novel can take weeks to read, you know. A short story is sort of designed to be consumed in a sitting, so it's very easy. And a lot of great movies have been adapted, Rear Window, an example, from a short story. But a novel, you're constantly trying to figure out how to combine characters and, of course, eliminate things. I eliminated Lucy Mancini and the Doctor. But also you have to find ingenious, somewhat cinematic ways to take 60 pages and make it just take place in 5 minutes. In fact, the end of The Godfather, when they baptize the baby, and he's going to be the metaphor of The Godfather, that baby, by the way, was my daughter Sophia as an infant. She came into life baptized as a boy. So I thought, well, what if during the ceremony of the baptism, all of these pages of this guy getting killed and that guy getting killed were sort of all smushed together, you know? But I was trying to think of how to get through 60 pages of novel. I wasn't thinking of trying to do a great sequence. Turned out it was a good sequence, but very often the good sequence comes from the screenwriter struggling to figure out how to deal with the fact that the novel is way too long.
Another audience member wants to know, was there always an intent to do a second and third Godfather movie when creating the first one?
Speak French. Absolument pas. I love to say that. When I got out of The Godfather, I was out. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I just had hated the experience. I was so miserable. I was made to feel so crummy that I wanted nothing to do with it. And, you know, Charlie Bluthorn by then was saying, but Francis, you got the formula of Coca-Cola. You can make it that way. I said, I can't do it. So what I finally did is I said, all right, I will help on the script. I'll work on the script. And I'll choose a director that I think could do it. And I'll be sort of a producer guy. And they said, well, they didn't like that idea, but they said, okay. So, you know, every time I said something to Bobby, to Bob Evans, it would be absolutely not. You know, Marlon, absolutely not. Al Pacino, absolutely not. So I thought now I had some leverage over him. So finally they all called me in and they said, well, who have you chosen to direct it? And I said, his name is Martin Scorsese. He said, absolutely not. So we were at a stalemate, and then Charlie said, Francis, you can have anything you want. I said, well, I want three things, I think I told him. One was, I want $1 million. Boy, that really sounded good in those days for a guy who lived on $60 a month, you know. I want $1 million. Oh, okay. And I want Bob Evans to have absolutely nothing to do with it. You know, and in truth, Bob Evans is a man who is not without talent. I mean, he produced or was the studio head with Chinatown. So he definitely has something, but somehow the way my experience was being under his thumb was just the most horrible thing. So my second condition, that he could know nothing about it. He couldn't read the script. He couldn't be involved in any way. So, okay. And the third condition, I said, is I want to call it The Godfather Part 2. And it came back that the only thing that they objected to was to call it The Godfather Part 2. And I said, why? And he said, well, because people will think it's just the second half of the movie that they already saw. And I said, well, that's what it's called. And it was so ironic because then, of course, that I was the guilty person for, you know, Rocky V and Iron Man, which I shouldn't be forgiven for. But I only got it from Ivan the Terrible Part 1 and Ivan the Terrible Part 2, which was the Russian film. So,
was there anything that you came across in assembling and handing this over to the publisher that reminded you hadn't thought about since you made The Godfather?
There were a couple of things, because they... I try to think of one that... There was a paragraph that I had underlined as being, this is what the book is about. And then they asked, well, why didn't that get in? And I said, oh, it did. Because in the scene, which was shot later, incidentally, there's a scene where Al Pacino comes back to Kay, who's now teaching. And we shot that in Mill Valley or San Rafael. Where?
Ross.
In Ross. Were you the kid on the bicycle? You know, that was my favorite piece of direction, that the little kid rides back and says, hi, Miss Jones. I mean, she's a teacher. You know, I thought I was so clever. At any rate, she says, Michael, where have you been? Why are you in my life? Please. And they have the conversation where he says, my family is going to change. You know, my father's like any important man, like a senator or something. That was all from that paragraph in the book. Another thing that happened, it's worthy to note, is that everyone was either didn't like the picture early on, although it was the same picture. And I understand that. You know, when you make something that kind of is a slightly new or takes another step, it sort of rubs people the wrong way a little bit, because they're not... It's like all those painters in France during the Belle Epoque, they were painting things and the Academy thought a painting had to look a certain way. So it's understandable that when a film takes a step, it could rub people the wrong way. That's why they didn't like my script of Patton, because Patton was a little weird and had that strange opening where it gets it in front of a flag. And people don't react well when you start fooling around like that. But then over time, it can stick, and then it becomes the new norm. But so no one really reacted. Even my cinephile friends in San Francisco would see a cut and, you know, well, that's good, Francis, you know, and I was devastated, you know. But I showed the film to Bob Town, who wrote Chinatown, who was sort of a couple of years older than me and sort of I looked up to as an older brother, and he saw the film, and he just thought it was great, which was like I didn't, and he's not the kind of guy who, you know, would give you phony reactions, so I was just so shocked and elated that this person I admired so much thought, and he loved Brando in it, and he loved the whole movie, and I couldn't believe it. And he said, one thing, though, it needs a scene in the movie between Michael and his father, where the father's now old and infirm, and Al is clearly going to be the new guy, and that they talk about, you know, sort of, he said something like, I never wanted this for you. So I said, oh, would you write it? And because I, you know. And he wrote that scene, wow, which is a beautiful scene in the movie. That's Bob Town wrote that as a favor to me. And I always try to, you know, in these movie business, which is collaborative, I always try to say who really had the idea.
Yeah.
You know, like John Milius had the idea of the helicopters with the ride of the Valkyrie. The actor Clemenza improvised the line, leave the gun and take the cannoli. What I had done to contribute is that when he leaves, I told his wife in this thing, says, and don't forget the cannoli, because I wanted him to pick up the little box like my father used to bring home at night. But so we did have him buy the box, but I hadn't thought of his line, which was, leave the gun, take the, that was, and very often, you know, actors come up with this stuff. I always hate it when people say, oh, you got such great performances out of those. You absolutely do not get performances out of actors. The actors give the performances. The director's just like a coach or tries to make the situation stimulate them and make it comfortable for them. But the actors are remarkable artists. I always make the comparison. They're like a cellist, except there's no piece of hardware between them and the audience. They have to, their instrument is themselves, and that is very difficult to do. And that's the reason why in rehearsal when the actor is criticizing the script, because actors love acting in movies and scripts, and they know a lot about it. And of all the people in the movie business, the screenwriters, the photographers, the editors, the producers, who become great directors, by far it's the actors that become great directors out of all those other professions. When you think back of even people like Charles Laughton, when he finally made one film, it was a great movie, Night of the Hunter. So actors, you know, they tend to make fun of actors, like, but the actors are extraordinary people, what they do. And if a director, if you want to be a good director, you have to love what actors do, and you have to love actors, I think.
So,
oh, I had an actor in the room.
So after all these years, The Godfather sits firmly in the firmament for people all over the world as one of their favorite films. It's on everybody's top five, I'm sure, in this audience. And I submit there's at least 30 films in my top five. But where does Godfather sit for you in the firmament of films that you have made? What has it taught you and what legacy has it?
It's hard to separate. When you're a director, you're actually there not just for the 2.5 hours. You're there the whole day, and it's hard to separate whether the experience was good for you personally or not. It was an awful experience for me. And also, it was so successful when it finally, you know, dug in that, you know, my mother and father had went into the Godfather industry. They were writing the Godfather album, and that, you know, everyone around me gets Godfather crazy. And when I walk into places, I hear da 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 da. I hate that. Although I will tell you a nice story, if there's time for a story, is when I chose to direct to compose the music. The studio sort of had, I think they wanted Henry Mancini to write the music because he's Italian. He's a great artist. But I chose Nino Rota, not only because I love Nino Rota from the Fellini pictures. Better reason than that, I love the score he did for Rocco and His Brothers. Rocco and His Brothers by Visconti had this deep, you know, da 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 da, and it felt like The Godfather to me. So I chose Nino Rota, and I went to meet him. He was the most delightful man, very small, petite man. What I loved him so much is because if you said to him, "Oh, Nino, play this, play the score from Il Bidone," he would do it. he loved to play the White Sheet. He would do it. He loved to play the tunes from his movies. And we worked together very well. It was a very wonderful experience. And then I left, went back to L.A., and then I was to return when the orchestra recorded. But we could never agree on a love song. And I said, I want something sort of almost Arabic, almost, you know, Sicilian, but really modal, like, you know, da, da, de, da, de, you know, those kind of Arabic kind of terms, because it was Sicily, and I don't know, I had this idea. So we never had that. I flew back a month later. We were going to record it, and at the airport, he met me, and he was such a fine gentleman, and we're walking, and he says, "Francis, I have an idea for the love song." I said, "What?" Da-da-da-da-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da. When I heard the dee-da-dee-da-dee, that was what I was talking about. And so I was thrilled, and that became this famous song. But when The Godfather went up for the Academy Awards, and of course the Academy Awards was all the American composers, they discovered that he had taken a tune from a movie he had written before that had a little tarantella. And because he used it in another movie, they threw the score of The Godfather out.
Oh.
Interesting. Henry Mancini.
Francis, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Francis Ford Coppola. So thank you to Francis Ford Coppola, whose book, The Godfather Notebook, is just out. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also wish to remind everyone here that signed copies of Mr. Coppola's book are for sale. I'm Adam Savage, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.